Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The world is ever-changing, but for the last 70 years or so, the United States' place in that world has remained relatively constant, and now that, too, is changing. Some of it is due to Donald Trump and his unconventional approach to foreign policy and the realigning of traditional relationships, but part of the reason is because long-held assumptions have fallen by the wayside. When the Soviet Union dissolved and became a more capitalist economy, and when it took hold as well in China, many assumed those countries would become more open to democracy. That has not proven to be the case. And with Russia at war with Ukraine and China talking more openly about their desire to take back Taiwan, the United States seems somehow less able to exert influence. David Sanger is the White House and National Security Correspondent for the New York Times, who writes regularly about this for that paper, and is the author of several books, including The New Cold Wars, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's Struggle. David Sanger is in Charlotte to speak today at the World Affairs Council of Charlotte at noon at the Hilton Uptown, for which there are still tickets available. But he joins us first. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Mike, great to be with you.
So given the changes that have resulted as a result of Donald Trump's approach to our allies and our enemies and the way that foreign policy seemingly is now conducted, how would you assess the United States' position in the world and our national security as well?
Well, Mike, I don't think it's saying anything particularly new to note that the days when we were the one great power in the world, post-World War II, and then again after the fall of the Soviet Union and before China's rise, those days are over. And that was an unnatural situation. It's not the usual thing in world history to have a single dominant power. It comes up periodically, but it was inevitable that there would be pushback as other countries rose and as other countries tried to reconfigure the system. When I set about writing New Cold Wars, which came out in hardcover in 2024, and we've got a paperback edition updated for the Trump years that has just appeared, what I wanted to do was try to solve one of the great mysteries surrounding an intelligence failure of huge dimensions. And, you know, usually when we think of intelligence failures, it's, you know, why was it that we didn't understand, what did we not understand about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, or what did we miss with North Korea or Pakistan? Instead, this was much bigger. This was, how was it that we deceived ourselves starting after the Soviet Union fell, and starting in the early and mid-90s, to believe that we could wrap China and Russia into a Western system and that they would sort of voluntarily decide that it was indeed the end of history, as Francis Fukuyama wrote so famously. And it wasn't just Professor Fukuyama who wrote this, and that the end of history was really liberal democracy. And what set of biases did we bring to our analysis of the world to think that? Partly it was a business bias, right? We had oil companies that were eager to get at Russia's oil and gas reserves. We had every American company looking at 1.4 billion Chinese and saying, we've got to get into that market. And by the way, we can manufacture there more inexpensively. So there was huge pressure on the US government to sort of race forward with this analysis, which was essentially that the more that we got China into the World Trade Organization, the more that we made Russia part of Europe, that they would become more like us and invested in the system. And, you know, for a while, you walked into the NATO headquarters, the old NATO headquarters before they built their new building in Brussels. And as you came through the gate, there was something called the Russia NATO Council, which was to try to prepare Russia to come inside NATO, the alliance that was designed to contain the old Soviet Union. When we look at this today, Mike, it sounds crazy. It sounds like we were insane. But the fact of the matter was, this was the dominant view when I was got finished with my happy life as a New York Times foreign correspondent in Asia and came back to Washington in 1994.
So you mentioned that it's abnormal for one superpower to be existent, to be in control of everything, and other nations, China, Russia, other nations were aligning themselves to take more power from us. But we seem to be helping that along under the Donald Trump approach to foreign policy. He seems to be sidling up to people that have traditionally been our enemies, or at least our nemesis, strongmen, dictators, people that we have not normally had warm relationships, while at the same time showing antipathy and even animosity toward our traditional allies. Is this the right move in this new environment where these things did not come to pass that we just talked about?
Well, look at it this way. If your own control is shrinking somewhat, if your own dominance is, then what do you need? You need like-minded friends and allies so that together you have the economic heft that you had when we dominated the world economy, so that together you have the political heft to get things done, so that together you've got the military capability that would come from the combination of the United States, NATO, and our treaty allies in Asia, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, Australia. And that if you sew these together properly, there'll always be tensions internally. I mean, that's like life, right? And we saw them in Iraq, and we've certainly seen them in the Iran conflict in very large measure. But that in general, you are vastly stronger than China and certainly than Russia, which is a relatively, small economy comparatively with nuclear weapons, but a smaller economy, than you would be if you're trying to do this alone. So the mystifying part about Donald Trump, and I've struggled with this in interviewing him from the 2016 election forward, and I've had several lengthy interviews with him, is why he views allies as a burden on the US, something that we're paying for, rather than a great benefit that extends our power and makes it less necessary for us to keep troops or an economic presence elsewhere in the world.
Have you figured that out?
No, it's something innate in his own view, I think, of when America was greatest. I asked him once in 2016, when Maggie Haberman and I were doing some interviews, his first foreign policy interviews in that campaign, his first campaign. I asked him, what do you think was America's sort of greatest moment that you would like to go, return to? And without hesitation, he said the 1950s. Now, think about this as a man who's 80 years old. So, in the 1950s, he was a young teenager and so forth. It was a time when America's major adversaries had been vanquished, right? And it was before Vietnam. And we looked like we were a singularly great power. And you hear it when he says, we don't win wars anymore like, we used to. You hear it when he said, in regard to Iran, just 11 weeks ago, the only deal I'm doing is unconditional surrender. These are the phrases that come from an America that won everything. And then you overlay that, Mike, with his view that it's the right and the destiny of the United States to spread itself geographically. So you walk into the Oval Office these days, Mike, and there are some portraits of presidents we don't normally think about, starting with James Polk. Now, why do you think Polk is up on the wall in the Oval Office?
Because he's from here? I don't know.
Well, that would be a really good answer. That's the best answer I've heard. Let me give you a second answer after the fact that he's from here. Okay. It's that he was the president who extended the United States out to the Pacific Coast, right? I mean, Donald Trump is at his heart a real estate guy, and this guy did real estate big time. Then there's pictures of McKinley. Why McKinley? Well, first of all, he loved tariffs. And secondly, he won the Spanish-American War and grabbed for the United States the Philippines, which he soon came to regret, Guam, Puerto Rico, and sort of set up the de facto conditions for Cuba. And we may be right back at that one in the next few months.
He says, Donald Trump has said many times that he has done things that other presidents were afraid to do.
That is certainly
And
true. That is 100% true.
his is the right approach in his mind. So you've covered five presidents from Bill Clinton to Donald Trump, including Joe Biden and everybody in between. Is he correct?
He has certainly done things that other presidents hesitated to do. Bombing Iran, it would be a classic example. And, I think he, you could argue that, he's done it twice now. He did it in June of last year, and famously, the war that began February 28th of this year. They were very different operations, and it's sort of interesting to think about them. In June, he sent B-2 bombers over overnight after the 12-day war was just winding down with Israel. They had three targets in mind: Natanz, Fordo, and Isfahan, the three major nuclear enrichment sites and storage sites in Iran. They bombed them with bunker busters. They did a huge amount of damage. I wouldn't say they obliterated the Iranian nuclear program, as he claimed, but I certainly would argue it set them back for years, more than we really knew at the time. And they came home. And there were a lot of America firsters who were unhappy about this and thought we were getting involved in a long war in the Middle East and all that. And he said, no, this was a one-night operation, right? And then he did another one-night operation in early January, which was taking Maduro out of his bed in Caracas with the Special Forces team and shipping him off to the Brooklyn Detention Center to stand trial for a long-standing indictment in the United States. Those were both sort of one and done evening operations where you could go in, do what we do best, a unique reach around somewhere around the globe, do your thing, get out. And then in February, sort of full of the success of these two, and I think persuaded that the US military could accomplish just about any political goal, he went and did Iran in a way that he couldn't get out of.
I want to talk about that when we come back from the break because Iran has not gone exactly the way it's been advertised, and maybe you have a take on as to why that may be. David Sanger is with us, the White House National Security Correspondent for the New York Times. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, David Sanger. He's the White House and National Security Correspondent for the New York Times, author of of New Cold Wars, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's Struggle. You also wrote the book confront and conceal Obama's secret wars and surprising use of American power, in which you took a behind-the-scenes look at what you describe as that president's aggressive use of cyber warfare, drones, and special forces to confront global threats. And you say Obama expanded the use of covert tools to project power while avoiding large-scale wars and concealing the extent of American involvement. So if I have this right, that book suggests these innovations brought short-term successes, but also raised some long-term questions about transparency and accountability and the future of warfare. If I have that right, how has that played or has it played any role in what's happening in Iran today and how that war is being prosecuted?
Well, President Obama and President Bush before him, Mike, ran with the Israelis the biggest covert cyber operation that we know of, and that's an important caveat, in American history. It was codenamed Olympic Games. Your listeners might remember it for something called Stuxnet, which was the computer code that was placed into the centrifuges that Iran uses to enrich uranium. And this was 2010, 2009, 2010, 16, 17 years ago. And at the time, it was the most sophisticated state-on-state cyber attack that we had ever seen. And it was deeply held secret. It took us 14 months to sort of dig it out. Once the code got out free outside of the Natanz nuclear plant, which was not intended. By accident, the code got out and started spreading around the world as computer viruses can, and we had a chance to go analyze it and track its origins, and the origins led us right back to the Situation Room. What was the purpose of Olympic Games? It was to try to slow down the Iranian nuclear program without getting into an overt war. Remember, at the time, we were still in Iraq and Afghanistan. And President Bush was famously told by his Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, "I think you've invaded your last country here. So if you're going to act against Iran, you're going to have to find covert ways to do it." And then that got passed on to Obama. And it slowed the Iranians down. I think it probably cost them a year or two of work, but they came back. They bounced back. For President Trump, it's the old use of American power, the send in the bombers, that really impresses him. When you go into the Oval Office, right by his bust of Lincoln, he keeps some models of the B-2 bombers that pulled off that raid on Iran that I described from last June. And somewhat remarkable he's got such a reliance on these. But what he missed in this current Iran attack, I think, was, as I said before, a belief that we could do anything. But in the previous actions in Iran and Venezuela, the military objectives and the political objectives were a complete overlap, right? You go in, you bomb some sites to set them back, you leave. You go in, you grab a dictator, you leave. In the February attack on Iran, he had an expansive group of political objectives. And it was those political objectives that he could not achieve despite weeks and weeks of bombing. He believed this was going to be a short war, a couple of days, that the Iranians would turn around and, as he put it later, cry uncle. I'm not quite sure where that belief came from, certainly not a study of the way the Iranians have dealt with long attacks on their sovereignty before, including the Iran-Iraq war. But that's what he thought was going to happen.
Well, as someone who has covered conflicts and who reports on our national security and foreign policy, let me get your take on this. You're kind of leading me down this path already, and that is that We don't seem to have achieved the goals, if the goals have ever been announced, that they don't seem to be having been achieved in Iran. We have not yet secured uranium, the enriched uranium that we went in there to get, both of which were major object. Well, that and regime change were major objectives, and the regime
And
has
the missile
changed,
program, don't forget about the missile
right?
program.
A
Yeah.
and the regime has changed, but it's the same regime pretty much.
The
We also.
regime is, Mike, the regime hasn't changed. The personnel has changed.
Okay.
Right? The
Certainly there are.
regime stays, looks exactly the way it looked. And Ayatollah, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, they're the ones who are running the country. It's just the older Ayatollah has been replaced by his son. I don't
Right.
call that regime change. I call
No.
that succession. Yeah.
So that has not occurred. Now they control the Strait of Hormuz, something they did not control before, and it appears as though, unless something brilliant happens in the next year or so, they will always have that at their disposal, and that has resulted in a world oil crisis, rising prices here, shortages elsewhere. Should this have been anticipated? Could it have been anticipated? And why was there no backup plan ready to go for this?
This is great question, Mike. So, first of all, it's long been anticipated. I mean, if you think about the two sort of war game scenarios that get played out the most at the Pentagon, in think tanks at Washington, in Washington universities, I've sat through hours of these before. It's two contingencies. It's the Chinese government taking over Taiwan, and it's Iran trying to seize control of the strait, which at its widest is, I think, 21 nautical miles, and they control a good deal of it. There's a narrow international waters passageway there, but it is pretty narrow. And as you point out with your question, they live there, so their ability to control it, particularly since they control one shoreline, is extremely high, and we don't live there. So if we're going to assure it's open, we have to keep forces there or have our allies that we were talking about at the beginning keep forces there. I think it's fair to say that the Pentagon went into this, or at least people who have done this professionally, knowing that this was an option. They also knew that for the 47 years since the Iranian Revolution, the Iranians have never done this. They didn't do it during the hostage crisis. They didn't do it during the Iran-Iraq War. They didn't do it after we cyber attacked their centrifuges. They've just never done it. But pressed to the wall, they did it. And we know the option was discussed with President Trump. But as you said, they went into this unprepared for how they would handle that situation. And that does raise the question about why the people who planned and approved this and all that still hold their jobs, right?
Is that an
Because
indication
what you're
that
supposed
they,
to do in the Pentagon is think about every option of things that could go wrong.
well, our military professionals surely did think about that. And by
Yes.
military professionals, I mean the people who have, the generals, the admirals, the people who have been there
And
in the
we think the
military for
chairman of the
years.
Joint Chiefs, Dan Kane, actually did raise this and, talked
So
about it
they're
as a
being,
possibility.
you're telling me that we can assume that they've been ignored.
We can tell you that the president came to the conclusion that the Iranian government would fall fairly quickly and this wouldn't be a problem.
The war in Iran began on February 28th. On March 9th, Trump claimed the war was very complete, pretty much. That's a quote. He said the Strait of Hormuz had reopened. We know it hasn't. Later in March, he said the U.S. and Israel had won the war. Also a quote. A ceasefire was announced in early April. It's been extended since then, but attacks have continued sporadically on both sides. And Trump has said that if the ceasefire fails, quote, then lots of bombs start going off. Recently on Air Force One, you asked him a question about renewed bombing that made some headlines. And I want to play that exchange first and then talk about it.
What would the use be of repeating the bombing? You did it for 38 days.
Well, no, we did.
And you did not get the political changes in Iran.
No, I had a total military victory.
And
But
not
the
a
fake
political.
news, guys like you, write incorrectly. You're a fake guy. And guys like you write about it correctly. We had a total military victory. We knocked out their entire Navy. We knocked out their entire Air Force. We knocked out all of their anti-aircraft weaponry. We knocked out all of their radar. We knocked out all of their leaders, number one, and then we knocked out all of their leaders in the second division, and we knocked out numerous of their leaders in the third division, and they're very confused. We've had a total victory, except by people like you that don't write the truth. You know, you should write. I actually think it's sort of treasonous what you write, but you and the New York Times and CNN, I would say, are the worst.
Of course, Donald Trump loves to go after the media, and he wasn't finished.
Your editors tell you what to write, and you write it. You should be ashamed of it.
Is there any?
I actually think it's treason. When you write like they're doing well militarily, and they have no Navy, no Air Force, no anti-anything. By the way, we knocked out 85% of their manufacturing for the missiles. We knocked out everything. We haven't knocked out other than one bridge, and we did because they misbehaved. But we have bridges we could knock out. We could knock out their bridges and their electrical capacity within 2 days. We could knock out the whole thing. And then I read the New York Times, and they act like they're doing well. And everybody knows it. That's why your subscribers are way down. You know, the Times subscribers are way down because it's fake news.
Way down.
So before we talk about the substance of what he said, I'm just curious, because I've seen this happen so many times on TV. What it's like to be on the other side of these ongoing dressings down from Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, do I look like a fake guy to you, Mike? look, there wasn't a whole lot of surprise here. We've heard this before. President filed a $15 billion lawsuit against the New York Times for, among other things, not acknowledging that he secretly won the 2020 election or something. I mean, you know, so nothing new here. There's a strategy of trying to discredit the mainstream media. I was not surprised by what he did. He used Truth Social to take issue with some news analyses I'd written in the Times before. We're glad to see that President Trump, a New York native, is such a loyal reader of the paper. And I hope that he and his friends continue to subscribe. And that could explain our not failing, but record subscriptions now of, I think, roughly 13 million people. But to the substance, it's interesting if you listen to him. He described all of the military accomplishments, and he had almost all of those right, right? We did sink their Navy. They didn't have much of a Navy, but we sank it. We did wipe out their Air Force. They didn't have much of an Air Force, but they've got almost none of it left. We did go after, the United States did go after the defense industrial base and did significant damage to it. However, as I said before, this war didn't start to accomplish military goals against the Iranian government. It started because the president set certain political goals, forcing them to give up their nuclear program, forcing them to limit the range and numbers of their missile arsenal, encouraging the Iranian people, as he said the first night, to rise up against their government and overthrow it. I could go on with his political objectives. Mm-hmm. Those did not happen, as you said before. And he is answering the political question by giving me a list of his military accomplishments.
We know that he wants to discredit the mainstream media. He's been doing that since he came down the escalator, and maybe even before that. But he and has, with you and many others before you, referred to you as fake news. You were just called a fake guy. There's video to this. I watched the video. When he said that, you chuckled. He also said that you don't write the truth, that he believed that your assertions are treasonous, which is a pretty big charge. And you're not the only reporter that he said things like this to, or has insulted or pushed back on in a way that no other president has ever done before, and I'm just curious why no one ever pushes back.
So, good question. Look, I have a job. When I get up there, I was in the pool, right, which is the group of reporters that rotate through and cover the president. We were on Air Force One, and during that particular clip, flying back from the summit in China. Fascinating trip. And my job there is to ask questions of the president, try to elicit answers that will both push forward what we know from a news viewpoint and enable us to write analytical pieces. My job is not to sit there and get into an argument with him. And I knew that if I did, you know, the news would become the argument between the New York Times correspondent and the president. Not my job.
But that's the standard answer. The standard answer is, I don't want to be the story. I report on the story. Yeah. But he made you the story, and he makes other reporters the story. And when he says you're fake news, there's a whole cadre of people who absolutely believe him. What he's saying is true. So are we doing a disservice journalistically by not pushing back on those assertions?
You know, I knew I would have plenty of time to go answer them if I did it right there with him. I'm sure I would have cut off, and he would have been cut off by him. And he's the president. He's going to express his view, and he's entitled to his view of the news organization. But let's make a few things clear. Reporting is not treason. Reporting is the constitutionally protected function that the First Amendment was written for, right? And we are there to question authority. And by the way, he's not unique among American presidents in disliking our coverage. Our publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, noted in a speech last week that Lincoln hated our coverage of the American performance at Bull Run, which was nothing to write home about, the North's performance. FDR didn't like our coverage of, Wilson hated our coverage during World War I. FDR didn't like our coverage of the secret operations to help the British. He didn't like our coverage during World War II. Nixon certainly didn't like it, and I can tell you others didn't like Afghanistan and Iraq.
David Sanger is with us, White House and National Security Correspondent for the New York Times. We will continue our conversation and take a trip to China in a moment.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte, offering an international curriculum and IB diploma program for high school students designed to help prepare them for college, careers, and a global community. BISCharlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. David Sanger is in town to appear today at noon at the World Affairs Council of Charlotte Luncheon, but he's with us now. He's the White House and National Security Correspondent for the New York Times and author of New Cold Wars, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's Struggle. Before we move on to China, Donald Trump campaigned largely on domestic issues and making things cost less and helping average Americans who struggled during the Biden years with inflation. And inflation is worse today than it was then, largely because of things that he has done, tariffs, the war in Iran, etc. And he seems to be turning his attention, as you have alluded to other parts of the world other than the United States, Venezuela, Greenland, Iran, Cuba. There are probably other places that he has his eye on. And it's not uncommon for American presidents in their second term to turn their attention to the outside world, I guess to put their stamp on world affairs before they exit the stage. Is that what's happening here, or is this some kind of new kind of expansion, like the Monroe Doctrine on steroids?
Yeah, well, he calls it the Donroe Doctrine, and we've talked about that in the. I don't think he made it up, but he certainly has adopted it. We discussed this in the January interview that I did with several of my colleagues on the White House beat at the Times. So it's pretty clear that the president has a series of legacy things he wants to do at home and abroad that he considers critical, whether they are popular or not. And he has doubled down on some things that, if you believe the polls, are pretty unpopular. The Iran war, I think more than 60% of Americans polled think was a bad idea or don't want to be in it. The ballroom is a particular obsession of the president. When we went in to interview him, he took out of his desk drawers a model of the ballroom. Actually, he's got several of different sizes, showed us the different options, puts it down on a big photographic map of the White House campus. He's a builder. This is what he's thinking about. Then he moved to Lafayette Park, then to the arc the arch that he wants to build just across the river between the Lincoln Memorial and Arlington National Cemetery. So this is where his head is at.
But
on the domestic side, and on
the foreign side,
it's on, as we discussed, these questions of expansion, Greenland, Cuba, so forth.
It seems tone deaf. I mean, he has said that he doesn't think about the average American when he's prosecuting this war in Iran. He's thinking about their not getting a nuclear weapon. And I suppose that's very, 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 very important on the one hand. On the other hand, it sounds a bit like Marie Antoinette. Let him eat cake.
Well, it's a little black and white. I mean, you could consider the question that nobody wants Iran to get a nuclear weapon, right? Then the question is the only way to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon to conduct this war that did not seem, as we were saying before, to accomplish the immediate objectives? Could you do it with sabotage? Could you do it with even greater sanctions? Could you push off by interfering with their supply chains the moment where they could get a weapon considerably, which is the choice that other American presidents made, Bush and Obama and President Trump himself in his first term. In other words, it's not as if the choice is simply to go to war or not to go to war. There are lots of ways to stop a country from getting a nuclear weapon. Sometimes we have succeeded. South Africa would be a good example. Sometimes we have failed. North Korea would be the most famous example. What lessons can we learn from those experiences along the way? Because frankly, one of the biggest concerns now, Mike, is if you're the new Iranian leadership and you look at what has happened to you since February 28th, you may be more motivated to get a nuclear weapon, to say to yourself, you know, there's a reason that Donald Trump did not attack North Korea is because they already have nuclear weapons.
So what you're saying is that some of his moves may be working against him in ways he did not anticipate. And it also seems to me that the way he conducts almost everything, not just foreign policy, well, we'll see what happens. Or it seems like he doesn't have a plan, or that the sands shift constantly under his feet. So domestically, we don't know what he's going to do. Internationally, they don't know what he's going to do. What does that do for how people view us and our dependability and our rock solidness in the world, if that's a word? What does that do?
Well, look at the debate underway in NATO today. The debate essentially centers on the question of, could NATO exist without the United States at its center? You saw the German chancellor go to France last year and explore the question of whether or not the German government could be under the French nuclear umbrella. Now, the French don't have very many nuclear weapons, so it's not a terribly big umbrella. But we've never before seen a NATO member seek out the nuclear umbrella of another country because it fundamentally didn't trust that the United States would be there for it. You have seen the president side more with Vladimir Putin in this war than with Vladimir Zelensky. You have seen this president take a complete reversal of his first term approach to China and basically try a detente, which, you know, great if it works, but at the cost to some degree of some longtime allies who have been trying to help build a wall to contain Chinese power. And you heard the president on that same flight back from China raise the possibility that he would consider aid to Taiwan as a chip to be negotiated back and forth with the Chinese. And when I said to him it was another exchange, not the one that you just played, Mike, when I said to him along the way, you know, that Ronald Reagan assured the Taiwanese that we would never consult with the Chinese government on our arms packages, he said, well, that was 1982. That was a long time ago. Well, yeah, because alliances are built over a long time.
With regard to that recent trip to China, Trump claimed that she explicitly praised the U.S. military for being strong. Chinese officials allege that Xi never said this. Trump often, as we know, makes things up. And when he makes things up about other foreign leaders and their relationship or what they say in private, how is that viewed by those other nations? What message is that sending to them and to our allies that he just makes things up out of whole cloth?
Well, my favorite on the trip was he said that Xi Jinping had told him that the United States was the hottest country on earth. And I mean, I realize they're talking through translators and all that, but somehow I think that, you know, I'd want to fact check the question of whether or not Xi Jinping literally said America's the hottest country on earth. Look, this was a fascinating trip, no matter what the president's hyperbole was about what she said to him or not. It was fascinating in part because we spent a lot of time in the run-up to the trip wondering what the big takeaways were going to be, big Chinese purchases of soybeans or agreements on artificial intelligence or whatever. And we didn't get a whole lot of that. We got some piecemeal pieces, some Boeing sales that were promised. But these were things I think the Chinese were going to buy anyway. So I think the bigger question is, did the strategic relationship come together in any particular way? And I think that she looked at President Trump, and certainly I'm sure he was impressed by the amount of firepower that was directed at Iran in the June of last year attack and most recently. But he also saw a country, I think, that has discovered a little bit of the limits of our conventional military power and maybe hasn't learned as quickly as we need to the lessons about drone warfare, about the possibilities of interrupting global commerce in response to a military attack. And I think all those factor into whatever Xi is considering for the future of Taiwan. I don't think Xi is getting ready to attack Taiwan anytime in the immediate future.
But he has said that any mishandling by the United States of the Taiwan issue could lead to great jeopardy in relationships. And Taiwan, although it's this little island off the coast of China that they claim ownership of, we get a lot of high-tech stuff from Taiwan, chips that are only made in Taiwan. And as we rely on high technology and artificial intelligence more and more and more, what's at stake here if suddenly the flow of those chips is cut off? And while we're on the subject of chips, this is a double question. He was adamant that TikTok be sold because it was a Chinese company, that its presence in America not be owned by a Chinese company. And yet he turns around and allows NVIDIA to sell chips to the Chinese, something that previous administrations have said absolutely not.
Right. So when the Taiwan issue initially came up in 1949, when Chiang Kai-shek retreated to the island, it was, as you said, you know, this question of the small, largely empty, but soon eventually democratic island off the coast of China. And President Trump, rightly, when his aides bring it up, you know, points out on a map, he says, look at Taiwan. It's 5 miles off the coast of China. Well, you know, closer to 100 miles. But his point is generally right, which is it's a much easier operation for the Chinese than for the United States, which would have to operate from half a world away to defend it. But Taiwan Semiconductor Corporation, now arguably along with NVIDIA, the most important company in the world, overwhelmingly makes the most advanced chips that we use, including NVIDIA's, including, by the way, the processor in your iPhone.
Right.
Right? So if China takes over Taiwan, don't break your iPhone, because you're going to run into a little problem replacing it for a while. So we have a supply chain issue with Taiwan Semiconductor that's huge. And I have to credit the Trump administration for thinking through the supply chain issues more thoroughly than we've had governments think them through before. I think the Biden administration was on the road to doing that, but didn't move fast enough to make sure that we are not so fully dependent on a single territory that China wants right off to the Chinese coast. And this is a big subject of new Cold Wars. I went to Taiwan. My researcher and co-writer Mary Brooks, we spent a lot of time at Taiwan Semiconductor. And we asked the question, is the existence of Taiwan Semiconductor actually the best defense Taiwan has? Because the Chinese need their chips as well. They can't make the most advanced semiconductors. They're trying to, but they've had a hard time doing it. And the answer that I think I came to after a good deal of time out there and a lot of interviews is that as long as the Chinese are equally dependent on Taiwan Semiconductor as we are, I think Taiwan is relatively safe from massive invasion. The Chinese might try to squeeze it and control it more and more. But at the moment that China can make those chips itself, then I think Taiwan's got a really big problem. And so do we, if we can't figure out how to go do that kind of manufacturing in the U.S. And this was, you know, we started this conversation, Mike, talking about a big intelligence failure. Well, a big business failure for the United States was many individual companies made the decision to go manufacture their stuff at Taiwan Semiconductor because they couldn't imagine an interruption of the flow. Chips aren't heavy. You can put them on airplanes. You can have them here the next day. And the result is we became wildly too dependent on this one manufacturing company in a very vulnerable place. And how we made that decision without the U.S. government intervening and saying each of these individual business decisions make sense, and collectively they make no sense.
We're coming to the end of the hour, but I'm just curious about the impact of our terribly bifurcated, divided domestic politics and how that's viewed in terms of American power in the world, and how in terms of our stability, because the pendulum swings now are dramatic from Democrat to Republican, Biden to Trump, etc. How is that viewed? Are we increasingly viewed as unstable and undependable, or am I exaggerating that? I only have about a minute left.
So we've got two simultaneous questions, problems here. First of all, Donald Trump is considered to be a disruptor. He'd be happy to hear that, right? I mean, that's sort of what he went in to go do. But you could tell during the China trip that Xi Jinping's approach to the world right now is to say, I'm the stable one. Putin and Trump are not. And then you add to that instability our own domestic turmoil, which we should devote a second show to at some point.
Well, you're welcome back anytime. Okay. Tomorrow Thank would you. Be good, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
David Sanger is the White House and National Security Correspondent for the New York Times, who endured the slings and arrows of Donald Trump's criticism recently on Air Force One, along with many other reporters. I have more questions about that, but that is also a show for another day. Thank you very much for the hour.
Thank you, Appreciate Mike. It. Great to be with you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.